business like show.
Welcome to this edition of On Broadway. On Broadway is the podcast of soundsofbroadway.com, your 24/7 online Broadway radio station, playing the best from off-Broadway, Broadway, and the London stage. I am very happy today to have as my guest Kristen Staltz-Presley, who is a theater historian and author. And she has written a book about Dorothy Fields entitled Dorothy Fields and Her Life in the American Musical Theater. And I guess the title of the book, because it's all in caps and in bold, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's so good to be here, Stu. And I'm going to say something about that title. So I wanted it just to be Dorothy Fields in the American Musical Theater, right? I wanted her to be front and center. I wanted her name in bold, right? But the publisher, who knows way more about books than I do and how to sell books than I do, said, no, it needs to be a song title because nobody will know Dorothy Fields, which is a point that's very well taken. So it was the publisher who put the song title on there, and that's the reason why. So I learned something about publishing in deciding on a title for this book.
Why don't we stick with that? Because that was one of her signature songs that she wrote. But when she wrote it, it seems like with a lot of songs, because I know this was with Irving Berlin, you write a song and then it's a dud. And then maybe up to years later, the song is reintroduced and bingo, it is a massive hit. And that was a massive hit for her.
It was huge for her. And you're right. She had been writing for shows at the Cotton Club in Harlem in the mid 1920s. She was a young lady in her early 20s at the time. And she had been writing at the Cotton Club with composer Jimmy McHugh. And they had written a number of songs. And then they got a chance to kind of move downtown and started writing, not for Broadway yet, but for another nightclub. And they wrote some different songs for some different reviews. And one of them was, I Can't Give You Anything But Love. And then they got not a whole lot of great response to it. And then the chance came to try it again, and it took off like hotcakes. So you're absolutely right. I don't know. It's all in the timing. Who knows what is the secret sauce for having a big hit? But it was a big one.
I think people are familiar with Dorothy Fields. If you mention her name, you maybe get some nods like, oh, yeah, sure, I know her, but probably on a peripheral basis. And when you read this book, you really get to know Dorothy Fields. And for me, I guess I know Dorothy Fields from her later work, but knew nothing about her early work, about her family life. So can you give a brief introduction about her? And then why did you feel you needed to write a book about Dorothy Fields?
Well, I would say you can't talk about Dorothy Fields, and you'll find this in the book. I spent the lion's share of the first couple of chapters talking about her father. So her father, Lou Fields, was an enormously successful, not only performer who'd started out in vaudeville. He was part of the Weber and Fields team, started out in vaudeville, and Weber and Fields together became very, very successful producers. So you would imagine Lou Fields had four children with his wife, Rose. You would imagine that they would just kind of follow into the family business. But in fact, Lou Fields was dead set that they would not do that. He wanted his children to grow up to be far more, quote unquote, respectable than he considered himself to be as a performer and producer of theater. And he wanted his children to be doctors and lawyers and all of those things a lot of parents still want their children to grow up to be. Well, the joke was on Lou because three of his four children ended up in the business, in the theater. That is. And Dorothy, of those three, her two older brothers were writers. And Dorothy probably was the most successful of all three of them as a songwriter and librettist. But like I said, she was raised in this home where she was constantly surrounded by theater making, but she was actually not allowed to go to the theater until she was probably close to 10 years old. Lou and Rose really kept the children away from the quote unquote family business. Nevertheless, it was when her father asked her to keep his scrapbooks of all of his goings on that she began to really get interested in theater making herself. She then went on tour with her father. They took a big train ride across the U.S., Weber and Fields did, and did a big jubilee kind of anniversary reunion tour sort of thing. And Dorothy was part of that, or not to perform, but rather just to spectate, and absolutely was smitten with theater from then on out. So she, against her mother and father's best wishes, became involved in theater first as a songwriter. She had done a lot of poetry writing as a student in high school and had won a number of awards for her poetry. So it made sense that she would go into songwriting. And that's exactly what she did. She met up with Jimmy McHugh, a couple of, you know, there were some fits and starts where she tried her hand with some other composers, but ended up working with Jimmy McHugh. And like I said, McHugh got the job at the Cotton Club and said, "I want Dorothy Fields to write the lyrics with me." So off they were off to the races at that point.
Can you give us a time frame?
That was in later 1920s, yeah.
Right. I just wanted to get a time frame for people because, again, if you know Dorothy Fields from her later work, Sweet Charity, Seesaw, but she goes back to the early part of the 20th century and starting off with writing songs. And you mentioned Jimmy McHugh as her first real collaborator, and they were together for quite some time, weren't they?
Well, they were together until about 1935 or 36. So after the stock market crashed, when so much of New York theater making was put on hold or greatly reduced, a lot of those songwriting teams, like the Gershwin brothers, for instance, George and Ira Gershwin, and a number of other composers, Jerome Kern, went out to Hollywood, right? Because film is just beginning to ramp up, and you got to have songwriters to write music, even if it's just incidental music. So these songwriters who couldn't find work necessarily in New York could find it in LA. So a lot of them went to LA. Most of them hated the work of being a part of a film because it was so very different from making a show. But nevertheless, they did it because the money was really good. And it was a job, and they needed a job. So they worked together until about 1935. There were a few things they did after that, but not significantly. She was paired by the studio with Jerome Kern, and in the mid-1930s, and something happened with McHugh, whether it was jealousy, who knows? You can get 100 different answers depending who you ask. But something happened in the relationship with McHugh and it went south. And from that moment on, she was writing with Kern until his very untimely death in the 1940s.
Dorothy Fields, I believe, came up with the idea for Annie Get Your Gun, which we all know as the Irving Berlin musical. However, that's not how it was supposed to begin. So I'm assuming, and let us know about this, but I'm assuming when Dorothy Fields came up with the idea, she would write the lyrics and I'll get my old buddy, Jerome Kern. And I know Rodgers and Hammerstein produced Annie Get Your Gun, and they had to do some convincing because, of course, Oscar Hammerstein II wrote Showboat with Jerome Kern. So they were all sort of mixed together, but I'm assuming Dorothy Fields was the lure to bring in Jerome Kern.
Yeah, so it was her idea. You're absolutely right. She was working as part of the USO and saw someone come in with some medals on his jacket. And it just occurred to her, what about Annie Oakley, the sharpshooter? Those medals made her think of prizes for sharpshooting. And Annie Oakley occurred to her. Now, what's interesting is that one of her brothers had written a play about Annie Oakley. So it was definitely in her subconscious, Annie Oakley. And she happened to think, well, what if we tell the story of Annie Oakley in a musical? And she took it to her good buddies, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein. And they were immediately on board. And you're right, they saw it as an opportunity to get Jerome Kern, who was pretty comfortable in Los Angeles at this point, to get him back east in order to entice him to come back and write the music for Annie, what would become Annie Get Your Gun. Oscar Hammerstein promised that they would do a revival of Showboat. And so he said, if you'll come back and write the show with Dorothy, we'll do a revival of Showboat. And for whatever reason, that convinced him to come back. Well, of course, not long after he came back, he was walking in New York City and suffered a stroke and collapsed and was in the Pauper's Hospital. And it wasn't until someone discovered that he had, I believe it was his membership card to ASCAP, perhaps. And somebody said, oh, wait a minute. This isn't just anybody, right? This is Jerome Kern. And he obviously died in the wake of that brain injury. They brought in Irving Berlin, and Dorothy very graciously said, you know what? I'm going to have my hands full writing the libretto. So Irving, I know you always write your own lyrics. You do that. I'll do the libretto, and we'll see if we can't make a go of this show. And they did.
She wrote the book of the musical with her brother, Herbert. And they did a number of books. In fact, Herbert, I know you said Dorothy Fields might have been the most successful, but Herbert wrote, I think, 18 Broadway librettos, a lot with Rodgers and Hart. But she wrote the book with him, and I believe she wrote a couple of other books with him.
She did. She wrote several librettos with Herbert, and I believe they wrote 9 together. They wrote several with Cole Porter in the early 1940s, Let's Face It, and Mexican Hayride. Then they also wrote Redhead together in 1959. They wrote the libretto for that. They won a Tony Award for that one. Of course, it was directed by Bob Fosse and starred Gwen Verdon. I believe it was Fosse's first directorial turn. Of course, he'd worked on Broadway before, but this was his first time at the helm of his own musical. So they wrote a number of shows together, often working with Ethel Merman. She only wrote librettos in tandem with Herbert. She never wrote a libretto on her own. Now, her lyrics, on the flip side, she only wrote on her own. Herbert did not write those with her. She did those on her own. But yes, they worked together. And it's so interesting, this relationship that we see throughout her life with Richard Rodgers. There was definitely a real flirtation between a teenage Dorothy and a slightly older, but still teenage Richard Rodgers. They lived not too far from each other, and they became very good buddies. And then as Rodgers began writing with Lorenz Hart, who was it that put their first song into a Broadway musical? But that producer I mentioned earlier, named Lou Fields. So the Fields family can, in a lot of ways, be credited with kicking off what went on to be colossal success of Richard Rodgers.
I'm trying to think. I mean, we have a lot of composers that write their own music and lyrics, but you have very few that write lyrics and book. I mean, you have people like Meredith Wilson had done that a couple of times. So that was just unusual, maybe to begin with. And then at that time, to have a woman writing being very successful for the Broadway stage for movies, you just didn't really see that.
Oh, not at all. In fact, certainly not to the extent that Dorothy was doing it. You know, you look at her career, and she started in the mid-1920s, and she was still writing when she died suddenly in 1974. So her career spanned more than 5 decades. I say she was still writing. She came home from a rehearsal for a national tour of Seesaw, which was a musical that she had done with Cy Coleman writing the music. And they rehearsed that day. She came home. She had a message on her machine that she'd been nominated for a Tony Award for that musical. And she was supposed to be in an engagement later that night and didn't show up, and come to find out she had passed away suddenly in her apartment. So she was working right up until the very end, which not only speaks to her skill, but also to her ability to change with the times, right? She's able to write super jazzy, fun music with Jimmy McHugh in the 1920s and early 30s. And then she can write film music with Jerome Kern. And then in her 60s, she's writing shows like Sweet Charity with Cy Coleman, which is super jazzy. We're starting to introduce electric instrumentation into pits in theaters. So she just was able to bend and flex, and where a lot of the kind of boys club that she was working around, Irving Berlin in particular, was famously quoted as saying, you know, I feel like people stopped buying what I was selling. Well, Dorothy said, if they're not going to buy what I'm selling, I'm going to change what I'm selling. And that, I think, was a real secret to her long-term success. There were other women writing. Betty Comden obviously comes to mind. Carolyn Lee comes to mind. But with the exception of Betty Comden, Dorothy worked by and large far longer and to much greater success than anyone else working in the field. Now, Dorothy would be the first person to say, you know, let me help other women get a leg up in the industry, right? Mary Rodgers in particular. There's an anecdote where after her brother Herbert had passed away, Dorothy was really floundering. She needed a writing partner. Mary Rodgers, of course, was composing at the time. Once Upon a Mattress had already been on Broadway. So Dorothy saw Mary, the daughter of her dear old friend, Dick Rodgers, and said, why don't we write a song together? And it was Mary Rodgers who turned her down. It's kind of astounding when you hear Mary Rodgers' explanation. She says, I just felt like we needed a man to write with us. It felt like you had to have a man to write with you. And I think that's really, really telling as we look back at the songwriters from a historical perspective on Broadway and in film music and show music. I think that's a really telling comment for Mary Rodgers to make. But as a result, they never worked together, though Dorothy certainly tried to say, hey, let's do this. I can help you. You can help me. And it just never happened.
If you read the memoir of Mary Rodgers that she wrote about with the New York Times theater critic Jesse Green. She talks about that, but she also mentions in that memoir that she regretted that, that she regretted not taking it on because of what you said. And again, when you're reflecting on a memoir, you can look back decades earlier and say, I wasn't as confident in myself. You look at a lot of the pictures in your book, and she is surrounded by men. There are all these composers, all these people. It's all men. And here you have this woman. You talked about Betty Comden, who is fabulous, but it's always Betty Comden and Adolph Green. Yeah. But Dorothy Fields was the person by herself. And you had her collaborators really want to work with her. It was, no, no, I want to work with Dorothy Fields. Why was that?
I think that she was a very reliable collaborator. By that, I mean, she was very disciplined. I mean, she was a mom of two children. So she was trying to run her household at the same time that she was trying to run a very successful songwriting business. So she would get up first thing in the morning. It drove some of her collaborators, namely Cy Coleman, crazy because he was still very much on the club circuit at night as a, you know, in his mid-20s when they started working together. But Dorothy would be up at 8 a.m. She would write. Whether it was good, bad, wonderful, whatever, she would write on a yellow legal pad. She used blue pencils. In fact, as I was taking notes for the book, I used legal pads and I had blue pencils made with my name embossed on it so I could feel as close to Dorothy as possible. But she was very disciplined in her work. And when she got to about 1 o'clock, she would stop for lunch and to watch soap opera. And then she would get back to work for another hour or so. But when her children got home, she was mom. In fact, her son, David, who was born in 1940, said, I never saw her work. When I got home, she was mom. She was off the clock. But she was very reliable. She was very efficient because she had to be, because she was still a woman who was expected to do all of the things women were expected to do, particularly in the middle part of the 20th century. So I think that's one of the reasons. I think she was also something that I loved about her as I listened to interviews and as I read things that she said. She was not one who sought the notoriety for herself. So she was very quick to shine the spotlight on her collaborator or to say, oh, well, thank you for that. But how about that melody? I couldn't have done it without that beautiful melody. She was very quick to shift that spotlight. And I think that makes for a good partnership when you don't have someone who has to have all the accolades. She was comfortable saying, oh, well, I appreciate that. She was confident enough in her own work that she didn't necessarily need the external validation. So she was able to pitch that to her collaborators, which I think was probably a secret to her success as well. But yeah, they loved working with her. She worked with 18 different composers throughout her career, and they all spoke very highly and enjoyed the process of working with Dorothy Fields.
You mentioned that there was the work, there was the family life. You talk about an interesting incident where she was young. And like you said, her parents were, we don't want you to go into the field. We want you to be a traditionalist, find a husband, settle down, have kids, and do whatever women do at that time. And she was like, no, I want to be an individual and work. But she then suddenly got married. Why don't you tell our listeners what happened with that first marriage?
Well, she did get married. She didn't want to get married. She married a doctor. And I think it was one of those, she wasn't yet successful enough to stand on her own. I mean, she got to the point by the end of her 20s that she was making the modern equivalent of $1 million a year. But at this point, she wasn't there yet. So she couldn't say to her dad, hey, dad, shove it. You know, I'm doing okay for myself. And so she was a little bit listless. She hadn't yet taken off as a songwriter, wasn't exactly sure what she wanted to do. She'd done some teaching at her alma mater, which was the Benjamin School for Girls. She'd worked as a drama teacher there, but she hadn't yet found her place in the world. And I think it was, let me appease mom and dad and I'll marry this doctor. And within no time, I mean, I believe an anecdote in the book about their honeymoon where she was kind of miserable from the very beginning. She moved back home very quickly after they returned to New York from their honeymoon. And she continued to live with her parents and he continued to have his own residence elsewhere in New York City. And they remained married until 1937, I believe. So they were married for probably 9 or 10 years, but it was definitely a marriage in name only. His name was Jack Weiner. He was, like I said, a physician, and he was everything her parents wanted her to marry, and yet not at all what she wanted to be married to. And so they finally divorce, and there's, you can't really find out a whole lot about that relationship. There's not much in the written record. Her son, who is so kind to give me his time and all the information that he has, doesn't have much to say about it. But she went on, for whatever reason, she must have met Eli Lam, who was her second husband, whom she was introduced to by the father of Stephen Sondheim. Herbert Sondheim worked with Eli Lam and said, "Hey, you got to meet Dorothy." And my best guess, and that's all that is a guess, is that when she met Eli, she really fell in love and said, "Okay, it's time to officially end things with Jack. So I'm going to get divorced now so that I can marry Eli." And that's in fact what she did. She divorced Jack in the late 1930s, married Eli in pretty quick succession, and then had David really within a year of marrying Eli. So once she met the man of her dreams, it was off to the races. But definitely that first attempt at appeasing her parents and following that quote unquote traditional path was a swing and a miss.
You mentioned Stephen Sondheim. Can you talk about her relationship and how they met, and did they work together or either of them influence each other?
Yeah, actually. So Stephen's parents, Herbert and Foxy Sondheim, they were known for giving really great parties at their apartment in New York, and later divorced. But nevertheless, at this point, they were together and were known for throwing great parties. And Dorothy was, you know, because of her success, because of who she was definitely available to that kind of upper crust party circuit in New York City. So she was known to the Sondheims. And like I said, Herbert was in clothing manufacturing, Herbert Sondheim, and he knew Eli Lam, who was a blouse manufacturer in New York City. And he said, "Hey, you know what? I've got this friend, Dorothy. I think you need to meet her." And so they met at a party that the Sondheims hosted, and that was that. It was pretty quick that they knew that they were made for each other, and that was that. Now, with regards to Stephen, they never, to my knowledge, worked together, but definitely there was significant impact. In fact, if you know the show Follies at all, Stephen Sondheim, when he wrote that, each song is written in the style of a different songwriter from the great songbook age. And the song Losing My Mind, which I love, was written in the style of Dorothy Fields. And what he meant, what he was trying to capture, was Dorothy Fields' ability to use someone, I believe Sheldon Harnick referred to them as kitchen sink words. So just common everyday language to express really big sentiments. So when you think about Losing My Mind, that lyric is, "The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so," it's like, "I'm losing my mind." So all these little mundane, you know, the coffee cup. What he was trying to capture in writing that song was Dorothy's ability to use just really mundane everyday things to express really large feelings. And so definitely his work was impacted by her.
Let's go back to Hollywood. So you mentioned during the Depression, a lot of the composers, lyricists went out to LA because that's where the jobs were, that's where the money was. Can you talk about her Hollywood years?
Yeah. So she was in Hollywood. Like I said, that was where the money was. So they followed the money out there. She was on contract with a couple of different studios, and she hated the way that they had to work out there. She would be with McHugh early on, and then later she was paired with just different random composers, and then finally with Kern, with whom she stuck with. But they would sit in a room, basically, and they would be paid a retainer, a weekly salary, maybe it's $1,000 a week or whatever it might be, to just come up with a song on the fly as it might be needed for whatever musical or incidental music. Background music. It didn't necessarily have to be a big song and dance number. And she said about that time, "I was amazed about some of the music that we wrote." She said, "We would write it and it would go in the film, and we had no other experience with that process. So we would see a movie and then be blown away by the music we'd written because we'd completely forgotten about it. They were so detached from the process of storytelling." But Dorothy loved storytelling. So you talked about how you don't often hear about people who write lyrics and librettos. Well, the reason for that is Dorothy loved storytelling. I think at her heart, she was a storyteller above all else. And so as soon as she got the opportunity to go back to New York and start telling stories all over again, which happened in the late 1930s, she took it and never looked back. Although she did write a handful of things for films post-1930s. her return to New York in 1939. It was never to the extent that she wrote them in the 1930s. So she really hated LA, although because so many of her friends from New York were there, they did have some swinging good times. I don't want to mislead you. They did have some fun together. I think George Gershwin, his house seemed to be the party pad where everybody would gather and have some lots and lots of fun. But by and large, she was very ready. She was a born and bred New Yorker, and she was so ready to get back home for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, Eli was there. Her love was there. Second of all, she could work again with the collaboration that theater making brings. And she missed that so desperately when she was in Los Angeles. And so there were a number of reasons she was glad to be back in New York City. But, you know, the filmmaking was easy money and it kept her afloat. It helped her to be able to support herself and her family in a time when a lot of families were really suffering through the Depression and the aftermath of that. So I think she would be thankful for it, but also thankful that that time ended.
And she did end up winning an Academy Award. So it's not like,
oh, yeah, I should have thought
like,
of that.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, she was out there just writing these piddling songs and it's in the right movies. She was getting, like you've said, a lot of accolades and the biggest one.
Yes. She was the first woman to win an Academy Award for a song. In fact, she wrote the lyrics to The Way You Look Tonight with Jerome Kern. And I love this anecdote about that. So Jerome Kern was famously insecure about his work. And so they had been paired to write together for a film, Roberta. And she had been brought in. He had already written the melody and she was brought in at the last minute to set a lyric to it. They did not work together. But apparently once Kern heard it, he was very impressed with the lyric. And when he got the opportunity to continue working with the studios, he said, I want Dorothy to come with me, which can you imagine? I mean, the dean of American songwriting is asking you, this 32-year-old, 31-year-old songwriter whose dad wants you to marry a doctor and not go into the family business. The dean of American songwriters wants to write with you. That's quite the feather in your cap. But at any rate, so they went on to write several films, but Swing Time in 1936, premiered in 1936, was one of the first and probably the most packed with hits. And he had written this melody for this song that would become The Way You Look Tonight. But like I said, he was famously insecure about his work. And so he would keep this bust of, I can't remember if it was Beethoven or Mozart, somebody, a bust of a great composer of classical music on his piano. And Dorothy came in one day and he said, let me play this for you. And he played the melody to The Way You Look Tonight. And Dorothy loved it so much and was so immediately overcome by emotion just at the beauty of this melody that she couldn't say anything. And what Kern, very insecure Kern, took from that was that she hated it. And so he said, Bach doesn't like it, or Mozart, or whichever one the bust was. He said, he doesn't like it. So we'll just throw it away. And Dorothy was like, no, don't throw it away. Don't throw it away. I just am so overcome. This is so beautiful. It's not that I don't love it. It's that I do love it. I can't speak. I love it so much. But that song almost ended up on the floor of his home in Beverly Hills because he thought Dorothy didn't like it. Well, it went on, of course, to be probably one of the most recorded songs of the 20th century and an Academy Award winner. So I think Dorothy was right in her response to that when it's just such a beautiful, beautiful melody that we've been overcome with love for it since it was written.
It's also a great accomplishment for her to work with Kern because, as you say in the book, he was notoriously, I don't want to say mean, but he didn't work well with collaborators. So as you said, she comes in with this sparkling lyric and you almost get the impression that he's transformed. He becomes younger, that it's almost like a whole new Jerome Kern.
It's really interesting, their relationship. He was significantly older than she was, but she was just part of the family. I don't know how that happened, but she was very close with his wife and his daughter. She just ingratiated herself to the whole family and was able to get away with saying things to Jerome Kern that nobody else could have gotten away with. And what it was about her that he found so enchanting, I don't know. Maybe it was the age difference. Maybe he could see something of his own daughter in her because she was probably closer in age to his daughter than to himself. Maybe there was something there, but for whatever reason, they worked incredibly well together. And you're right. He did not play nicely with a whole lot of others. So that was definitely a feather in her cap.
Do you know what was her favorite musical that she worked on?
Well, I know her favorite song was The Way You Look Tonight. Her favorite musical that she worked on? That's a great question. I've not read or heard her say that explicitly, but if I were trying to, Sweet Charity comes to mind because she had gone through, you know, from Redhead to Sweet Charity, she hadn't really worked. And so I imagine that after you think your career is over and suddenly it's sort of reinvigorated with this great up and coming composer in Cy Coleman, I think in that relationship, it was kind of reversed. She was in the current position and Cy Coleman was this up and coming songwriter. So the roles had kind of flipped. I imagine that was pretty meaningful to her. And then to have it be so successful, that I would imagine would be at the top of the list. Redhead, she fought for a long time to get that story told, probably for the better part of the 1950s, she was fighting to tell that story. And it went through a number of different iterations. And there were lots of challenges to telling that story, but she stuck with it and got it done and won a Tony Award for it. I imagine that was pretty gratifying. And I don't know this. Again, I'm just talking as someone who studied her life for 17 years. But she also wrote some musicals that I had never heard of until I started studying her life. They're very inconsequential, really, as the musical theater canon goes. But some of these stories I think are really cool. Like By the Beautiful Sea was a musical that she wrote in the early 1950s. And it was about a woman who owned a bed and breakfast in Coney Island, I believe. And I have to imagine that telling the story of these women with their own agency and women who are taking charge of their lives and women who aren't following the quote unquote traditional path, I think that had to be cathartic for her in a lot of ways. I'll tell you one of my favorite numbers from By the Beautiful Sea. In fact, it probably is my favorite number from By the Beautiful Sea, is a number that she wrote called I'd Rather Wake Up By Myself, in which she talks about, if I can't have the love that I want to have, I'd rather wake up by myself, right? If I have to rest my head with some big baboon I wouldn't be caught dead with, I'd rather wake up by myself. And that lyric to me, I don't hear that kind of language really anywhere else in the Golden Age, or not many other places in the Golden Age where you have female characters who are saying, I'm not just going to take this guy who beats me up or this guy who ignores me, like J. Pierpont Finch in How to Succeed in Business. I'm not going to put up with that. I'd rather wake up by myself. So I think that telling those kinds of stories, and she told those a lot, had to be really gratifying for her. But I've never read her say which was her favorite show.
For listeners not familiar with these shows, because even Redhead, she won the Tony Award, but it's not a show that's well known. You can go to my radio station, soundsofbroadway.com, because we have a nightly request show. So you can click on the request tab and search the database for songs from By the Beautiful Sea, Redhead, and other shows that she composed for, and you can hear some of these songs. Seesaw was her last musical, and it's a great score, but the show just didn't work out. And I know they had a lot of out-of-town problems. Was it a show that deserved better because of the score that she wrote with Cy Coleman?
It was with Cy Coleman. I love that score. I agree with you. It's such a great score. So many great numbers. There were problems after problems after problems with that one. One of them started with the star. So the star was going to be, or the female lead was going to be played by Lainey Kazan. And Lainey Kazan was told, in order to play this role, you have to lose X amount of weight. And she came into rehearsals and had not lost that amount of weight. So they were put into a position where they had to find a new lead on the fly. They ended up with Michelle Lee, who I think did it beautifully. But nevertheless, there were a lot of problems with that show. And it almost opened as quickly as it closed. But it was one of those stories where I think The Wiz has a similar story where it was about to close as soon as it opened, but the company pitched in some of its own money. I know with The Wiz, they did this huge advertising marketing campaign that brought people in, and it ended up being a huge hit. So Seesaw, the cast and company itself, was so invested in that show that they literally invested in the show themselves and bought themselves some time on Broadway, but it, for whatever reason, never took off. And I think the reason we don't see it, like we see Sweet Charity revived a lot, we don't see Seesaw as much, not even near as much. It's pretty dated. The music's pretty dated. I still love it. It reminds me a lot of that inaugural recording of Company. I love that, but it sounds very similar in its instrumentation. I mean, it's from the same era, so it sounds very similar. But for whatever reason, that one never took off. Nevertheless, I mean, she was nominated for a Tony Award for it. It did tour nationally. Like I said, the day she died, she'd been at a rehearsal for a tour of Seesaw, but it never took off. You know, interestingly, one of the shows that she had worked on with Cy Coleman was a musical of Eleanor Roosevelt's life, Eleanor. And I would love to get my hands on that score. Of course, it was never completed and it was never performed, but I would love to hear what kind of ideas she had for telling the story of that character.
Let me go back to one of the original questions I asked, which you did not answer. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, you know what I found was, so I started writing about Dorothy Fields as a master's candidate at the University of Kentucky in 2003. What I found, because I was a huge fan, particularly of the Golden Age of the American Musical, and I found that I knew, like, I could define Cole Porter's lyrics. I could tell you, I could spot a Cole Porter lyric from a mile away, or a Lorenz Hart lyric, or an Ira Gershwin lyric. I knew these, what do those lyrics sound like? They're so easy to pigeonhole their styles, their unique styles. And so the project there was to figure out, what is Dorothy Fields' style? No one had done that. She had not been considered from an academic perspective. So I set out to define, what is the style for Dorothy Fields? Well, then when I got my PhD at the University of Georgia in 2011, that was my dissertation, was looking at characters that she wrote. So I'm still working on Dorothy Fields' work, but instead I'm looking at characters. So I mentioned, like, Lottie Gibson from By the Beautiful Sea. I love that character. But digging into those, how are they different from the other characters from the Golden Age American musical canon? So Dorothy Fields had been a part of my life since 2003. And always in the back of my mind, I had a low-grade frustration that though she had done so much and had written more than 400 songs and had won Tony Awards and an Oscar and done all that she had done, her name was not in lights to the extent that I felt that it should be. When we think of great American songwriters, we think of Cole Porter and George and Ira Gershwin, and rightly so, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein. We should, right? They belong there. But why don't we think of Dorothy Fields? And so that was very frustrating for me, because to me, she should be on that Mount Rushmore of songwriters. And I think it was 2016, in May of 2016 or thereabouts, there was an article in the New York Times where there were two reporters who wrote this piece, and they talked about 2015, 2016 was the year of the woman on Broadway. And it rightly so. I mean, it was Waitress, which had an all-female creative team, and Eclipse, which was all women. Absolutely agree with their assessment. But in the piece, there was no mention of Dorothy Fields. And for whatever reason, that just reminded me that somebody needed to pick up the mantle and tell the story of this woman who has been largely forgotten, even though her music we know very well, but we've forgotten, if we ever knew, who she was. And so that was really what woke up this, or reignited the fire in me to tell the story of Dorothy Fields.
I will say, as a reader of the book, this really does give a full picture of her. And you really do appreciate her for all the accomplishments for so many decades. Like you said, going from the 1920s to the early 1970s. I don't care if you're a man or a woman to have that much longevity. In fact, you look at a lot of the big composers, and when they got older, their output really diminished, or the quality of the output wasn't as good as their earlier years. And here you have Sweet Charity and Seesaw, two great scores. When she was a little older, let's put it like that.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. When she was a little older. Yeah. So it was just frustrating as a historian to know what I knew and then feel like nobody else knew it. Right. So I felt compelled to tell that story, or at least do this, the little bit that I could to tell that story so that she got her due.
Kristen, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk about your book. Like I said, it's a really good read. And not only is it a good read, but then you have so much information in the back of the book. Here's all the shows. Here's the songs. Here's the collaborators. So you can really look at this information in chart form to get a good picture. So it's not just here's the descriptive information, but here's some other information to help fill out the picture of Dorothy Fields' career.
Well, listen, Stuart, I really appreciate you having me. Like I said, it's a mission of mine to tell her story. So any platform that I get to share what I know about Dorothy Fields, I'm so happy to do it and honored to do it. And thank you for giving me that platform today.
I've been speaking with Kristen Staltz-Presley, the author of Dorothy Fields and Her Life in the American Musical Theater. I Can't Give You Anything But Love. Baby. And Kristen is an author and theater historian. She has a great domain name, drbroadway.com. There's no DR period. It's just drbroadway.com. So anything you want to know about the book, about Kristen, just go to drbroadway.com. My name is Stuart Brown, and you have been listening to On Broadway, the podcast of Sounds of Broadway.com. Your 24/7 online Broadway radio station playing the best from off-Broadway, Broadway, and the London stage. I hope you will join me again next time for another episode of On Broadway.
There's no business like show, business like no.